Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. This is the first oral argument for 2017. It's case number 68460, O'Keefe versus the State of Nevada, Department of Motor Vehicles. Would you mind stating your appearances for the record?
Yes. I am Alana Kochka of the law firm of Umanowski and McCray, and in conjunction with the Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada, I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Kara O'Keefe.
Thank you.
Jordan Smith, Assistant Solicitor General, on behalf of the respondent.
Thank you. I'll ask Ms. Kochka, would you like to reserve 5 minutes for a rebuttal argument?
I would.
You may proceed whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, this case is controlled by the Nevada Supreme Court's decision in Knapp v. Department of Prisons. This is a 1995 case, but in that case, the Nevada Supreme Court held that the hearing officer did not err in reversing the employee's termination after concluding that the termination was too severe. The court agreed with the Department of Prisons, the hearing officer, and the district court that Knapp's misconduct was serious, showed shocking misjudgment, and warranted discipline. The only dispute in the matter was the degree of discipline. Here, the hearing officer in that case considered that Knapp's past work performance had been generally satisfactory or above, and that the Department of Prisons had not shown that Knapp's actions had significantly or permanently affected his ability to perform his work duties, and they were also Knapp's worst offenses. Therefore, the Nevada Supreme Court reversed the order of the district court and affirmed the decision of the hearing officer. That is the same relief we are seeking here today. Here, the hearing officer reasonably concluded that the reliable, substantial, and probative evidence did not establish that O'Keefe's termination would serve the good of the public service, and therefore the decision to terminate her should be reversed. The hearing officer found that a 30 calendar day suspension was a more appropriate penalty, and she considered three factors. The first was the nature of the offense, including the fact that the employee did not manipulate data or disclose data. The second was O'Keefe's 7 years of state service without any prior discipline. And the third was the DMV's failure to promptly investigate the matter and take immediate corrective action. The hearing officer said that it seemed disingenuous that the DMV considered this a serious offense on the one hand, but did not initiate disciplinary action until nearly 9 months after it learned of the alleged violations and after O'Keefe was scheduled to return to work at the DMV.
Well, I mean, for 9 months she was over at the Division of Insurance. What are you saying that the DMV could have done something in the 9 months when she wasn't even employed there anymore? And if so, what could it have done during those 9 months?
It could have conducted an investigation and did exactly what it did 9 months later. O'Keefe was still working for the state of Nevada, and whether it's another agency within the state doesn't really matter.
You think the Division of Insurance would have implemented DMV's recommended discipline?
Yes. I think as the state of Nevada, if DMV had determined that her conduct was so serious that she should be terminated.
So, okay, let me just explore this a little bit. What you're saying is, if your former employee, another state agency, says, while working here, she committed a disciplinary infraction, and here's our recommended discipline, that the state division of insurance then doesn't have to conduct its own investigation, it just has to do what the DMV recommended? Is that literally what you're saying?
I think, yes. I think that is what I'm saying. It's still part of the state of Nevada. If she was terminated from her position at DMV, arguably she wouldn't be entitled to the promotion that she had received from the Department of Insurance. And the hearing officer in this case found that there was no policy that said they couldn't investigate it. So the state doesn't have a policy saying, you know, if you go to another division of the state, that the prior employer can't investigate. It happened on their watch. If it was really serious, they would have investigated. And the...
Let's say you're correct about that. What is the effect? The question came up about concerns that were addressed regarding due process, but no findings were made in that area. So what is the outcome because of this delay?
The outcome of the delay is that it affects the just cause of the termination itself. And so the DMV was unable to prove that she should be terminated. This is a factor that you consider in just cause, is the delay in the investigation.
How was she prejudiced, though, by the delay in the investigation? I mean, whether it's the day after it occurred or 9 months down the line, how would that have changed if the ultimate decision was termination?
Well, I think it changed because of O'Keefe's inability to obtain some evidence she would have...
What evidence?
For example, the Carson City Sheriff's Office, where she made the telephone calls to, they record those conversations. They keep those recordings for a period of time, but by the time they brought up this issue, DMV brought up the issue, those recordings were long gone. So she didn't have the evidence of exactly what she had said. So that's one piece of evidence that was missing. Probably...
If she had had that, would that evidence have been helpful or even critical to her defense?
Well, it might have been helpful to her. I'm not the hearing officer. I didn't hear the evidence. But normally in a due process or a just cause kind of investigation, the promptness of the investigation is very important because the promptness gives the employee an opportunity to marshal evidence. There might have been other witnesses there to counter the two that had reported to her supervisor. I mean, there just could have been a lot more evidence that she could have used.
And I understand that. I'm sure we all would agree it's better to have a prompt rather than a late investigation, particularly in this situation where she didn't even know she was possibly subject to investigation.
Correct.
But Chief Judge Silver's question was about prejudice. Prejudice means it had an effect on the proceeding by not having the evidence. She had the evidence, she just didn't have it in recorded form.
She didn't have it in recorded form. She didn't have... there may have been some witnesses who overheard her conversation in the workplace. But
why would she be calling the sheriff's office anyway? How's that part of her job scope of what she was doing?
It wasn't part of the job scope. She admitted that. She was calling the sheriff's office on behalf of this friend to see where his DUI was in the process.
So that recording would have just memorialized what she said in her testimony.
Well, but the other employees said actually that she said a few other things, that she said that there was a customer at the counter, that it was a bigger misrepresentation than probably it really was. But that's the problem with delayed investigations of any kind, is that, you know, the same thing for statute of limitations on trials. I mean, the reason that you want it to happen quickly rather than later is that evidence disappears. So I think she was prejudiced in that sense.
Is it fair to say that your position is that an internal memorandum of the DMV giving discretion for dismissal overrides DMV prohibitions and penalties? And if so, how it cannot be true when the Personnel Commission never approved the internal memoranda?
Well, Bruce Breslow, the head of the DMV, wrote that memo. And he said, of course, that the appropriate discipline would be taken, which would make it discretionary. So that was her notice of the policy. And then on top of that, the penalties that, there were two witnesses who testified too, Wayne Seidel from DMV and Alice Dobell from DMV, the HR person. They both said that violation of the policy was discretionary, that it was not mandatory, that it was not zero tolerance. And so the promulgation of the policy itself with that penalty attached to it really flies in the face of the hearing officer's authority under 284.390, because it basically says, and the district court found this in the district court's order, He said that the hearing officer had no discretion, that she doesn't get to decide just cause, that the penalty is there. So basically, she doesn't have a job if she committed any violation of the computer usage policy. And don't forget that the computer usage policy has a very broad policy and applies to many things. And one of the things the hearing officer found here was that her access to the screen wasn't the same as manipulating data or disclosing data or things other employees had even been disciplined for, like sending a confidential file to a boyfriend or something like that, which was an example of one person who'd been terminated. So that's the problem with their penalties, their argument.
Well, here's the question, though. You're kind of blurring a couple things. You may not like the policy. You may think the policy is overly harsh because it's mandatory extreme termination for even minor things. You may also may not like that the policy is not always enforced, right? I don't like that there's lots of laws out there that are not enforced. I don't like that there's lots of unsolved crimes out there, right? But that doesn't change what the law actually is. The legal question is, what I understand you're saying is that the sending of a memo by the director actually changes what the policy is, regardless of how it's enforced or when it's enforced or why it's enforced, which, you know, that's an enforcement problem. Is that what you're saying, is that the director unilaterally has the power through a memo to change what the policy is?
I don't think he has the power to change the policy. What he has the power to do is say that discipline will fit the crime, the punishment will fit the crime, and that's what he said. He said the discipline will be appropriate to what the offense is. He said it may result in termination. Not that it will, or it can result in termination, not that it will result in termination. And I think he was just expressing this is a broad policy, and parts of it maybe would trigger immediate termination, but parts of it would not. And what she did was access a screen. She didn't do any transactions for anybody on it. She didn't change any data. She didn't disclose the data to anyone. But she did access the screen in order to help a friend and get certain information concerning the address.
Thank you. I want to let you know you have 3.5 minutes left
for
rebuttal. Thank you so much. Mr. Smith?
May it please the court. The district court correctly reversed the hearing officer for acting in excess of her statutory authority for committing an error of law by applying an incorrect standard of review. Under our statutory and regulatory scheme governing state employment, neither hearing officers nor the courts have the authority to sit as superhuman resource departments to second-guess the employment decisions of the executive branch. Rather, as the Supreme Court indicated in the Lipinski versus City of Reno decision long before Knapp, the only issue before a hearing officer is whether substantial evidence exists to support a finding of misconduct. In other words, the hearing officer is only required to find that substantial evidence exists to support an employer's decision to dismiss. This court reached the same conclusion without citing Lipinski or Knapp in the Morgan decision. Morgan is the May 2016 unpublished decision that the parties have cited. There, again, without citing Lipinski or Knapp, this court engaged in a very straightforward textualist analysis of the relevant provisions.
Right, but what's the provision here? Essentially, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand your position to be this memo, even though it's written by the director and was sent to all employees explaining the policy, has no legal effect whatsoever. Is that your position?
That's correct. As Your Honor pointed out, the policies are approved not only by the DMV, but also by the Personnel Commission. So a memo can override what's been approved by the Personnel Commission. And also, the memo is not inconsistent in any way. It says, you can be terminated. It doesn't say, for example, that you won't be terminated. It says that you can be terminated. And so that memo isn't in any manner actually inconsistent. And to the extent there's any discretion left even after that memo, that discretion is left to the appointing authority, not the hearing officer. As this court pointed out in the Morgan decision, which again engaged in a textualist analysis of NRS 284.390 subsection 6, this court looked at the definition of just cause and adopted the definition of just cause that the Supreme Court set forth in the Southwest Gas versus Vargas case. And in Southwest Gas, the Supreme Court defined just cause as one that's not arbitrary, capricious, or illegal, and one that is supported by substantial evidence and two, reasonably believed by the employer to be true.
And incorporating those two concepts, substantial evidence and the employer's reasonable belief into the definition of just cause is significant. NRS 284.390 sub 6 says, if a hearing officer determines that the dismissal was without just cause, but again, in light of this court's definition of just cause from Morgan, that provision is construed to read, if a hearing officer determines that the dismissal was without substantial evidence, and then it continues, as set forth in NRS 284.385, which in turn says, it is the appointing authority who determines whether the good of the public service will be served by dismissal. So taking 385 and 390 together, in light of how this court defined just cause in the Morgan case, it's clear that hearing officers are limited to determining whether substantial evidence exists to support the appointing authority's determination that the good of the public service will be served by dismissal. Allowing the hearing officer to make a de novo determination of whether the good of the public service will result from the dismissal allows the appointing authority to usurp the prerogative reserved by statute to the appointing authority. And that's exactly what the Supreme Court said in the Taylor decision, hearing officers cannot do. In Taylor, the issue is whether hearing officers can set discipline in addition to making recommendations. And the Supreme Court, again, making a very straightforward textualist analysis, said under the regulatory regime, only appointing authorities determine set discipline, and hearing officers are limited to only making recommendations.
Well, so let me throw this out. What about the nine-month delay? You're essentially pointing out that we have to give deference to what was found below, but what if, because of the delay, not all the evidence that could have been relevant to this case was even presented because the DMV acted so slowly and Ms. O'Keefe lost some evidence? Why would we give deference to that?
That was my question as well. I was just going to literally ask almost the exact same question because the hearing officer actually made findings that the DMV did not take action against O'Keefe immediately when it learned of her conduct. So why should this court accept those factual determinations?
The word promptness in NAC 284, I think it's 638, does not act as a statute of limitations. It doesn't insulate Ms. O'Keefe from discipline. In fact, the hearing officer, after perceiving a delay, still recommended some sort of discipline, meaning suspension. But there's no statutory or regulatory authority that says promptness is a mitigating factor that somehow renders a dismissible offense to a lesser termination. It's not a statute of limitations. The notice of her internal rights and being put on administrative leave was served upon her as soon as she came back under the DMV umbrella. Judge Tao's point is well taken. There is no mechanism for one department of the state to discipline an employee of another department of the state. Perhaps if there was some sort of mechanism or statute that allows that, this would be a different case, but there isn't one. And so the DMV, as soon as Ms. O'Keefe was back under their authority, they took prompt action. But returning to your
bigger point about hearing officers usurping the authority of the agencies, is this a problem that you're seeing? I mean, how is this unfolding? I mean, is this a novel issue? Why is this coming up?
This is highly debated. Different hearing officers take different approaches. The split is actually best exemplified by the Supreme Court's recent denial of petition or for further review in the Constantino case, where you had three of the Supreme Court justices, Justice Hardesty, Justice Pickering, and Justice Perry, saying Lipinski is the governing standard here. And due to the sitting senior justice, the case went the other way, 4-3 saying Knapp. But this is very closely divided here. At least three judges on the Supreme Court agree that it's Lipinski. But again, I think this court can do exactly what it did in the Morgan case, look at this from a textualist analysis, and adopt the definition of just cause, and find that hearing officers are limited to determining whether substantial evidence exists to support what the appointing authority did. And here, the hearing officer didn't do that. The hearing officer engaged in what she described as an independent determination of sufficient evidence. And despite finding substantial evidence that Ms. O'Keefe actually committed the offenses for which she was charged, she still determined that, one, it wasn't serious, and two, that the good of the public service wouldn't be served thereby.
Do you have any other jurisdictions, cases, just throwing it out there, and if you don't, that's fine, that interprets what good of the public means?
Not the phrase good of the public service as used in 385. I'm not aware of any cases on that point. But as far as what the meaning of just cause is, I think that the Supreme Court's decision in Southwest Gas Surveys, I believe it was an Oregon case and a couple others that adopted that standard. But as far as the hearing officer's determination that these aren't serious crimes or serious offenses and that progressive discipline should be imposed, these are serious offenses as a matter of law. NAC 284-646 defines these as serious offenses. It says an appointing authority may dismiss for any cause of action set forth in NAC 284-650. And Mr. O'Keefe was charged with three subsections of 650. Subsection 1, activity incompatible with the terms of her employment. 6, insubordination. And 18, misrepresentation of official capacity or authority. And so when NAC 284-646 defines these as dismissible offenses, they're serious as a matter of law, especially 646-2B, which says dismissal immediately is appropriate for misuse or unauthorized use of confidential information, which is the analog provision to the G1 offense for information misuse. And Ms. O'Keefe focuses on the word manipulation in the G1 offense, but that the G1 offense is defined as use or manipulation of information outside of your job responsibilities. The testimony, the evidence before the appointing authority and the testimony at the appeals hearing was that just opening up the database, whether it's looking up yourself, your friends, or your family, that is considered a use within the meaning of that. So while Ms. O'Keefe perhaps didn't manipulate any data, it is a form of use under the prohibition. And once the hearing officer determined there was substantial evidence that she used the database inappropriately, that should have been the end of the inquiry.
Let me ask you the flip side of the question. Let's go back to the 9-month delay for a second. The flip side of the question I asked your counterpart there. I'm, you know, not sure what the Division of Insurance would have done. Let's say, okay, Ms. O'Keefe leaves the DMV. The DMV then learns of possible infractions. Even though she's no longer there, the counter argument, the counter hypothetical that I'm posing here is this: even though they may or may not have jurisdiction to have to force the Division of Insurance to impose discipline on her for things that didn't occur while she was at the Division of Insurance, the one possible benefit to the DMV doing an investigation in absentia, if you will, is maybe they wouldn't have taken her back 9 months later. They would know that the approvable violation occurred, and maybe when she reapplied to transfer back, they would say, no, we have cause not to take you back, and then she wouldn't have started working at the DMV again, and then you have to initiate this whole thing. What's your response to that hypothetical?
It would sort of put it in procedurally in a tangle, because there is that provision that says she has a right to revert, even if she doesn't pass probation at the Division of Insurance, for anything other than egregious misconduct. She does have the right to revert. So even if they were to conduct the insurance, sort of the investigation in absentia, it sort of renders her in limbo. Presumably the division would then say, okay, you're no longer here anymore because of the misconduct that happened under the DMV's watch, but then under the regulation, she would then be allowed to almost revert back. And then at that point, who is firing her? Is it the Division of Insurance who would be involved in this proceeding then, or would it be the DMV? So the lack of a mechanism to address this, I think, would leave it in a procedural tangle that, again, I'm not sure what authority the Division of Insurance would have to fire her without conducting its own investigation, as you suggested. And finally, I'll address Ms. O'Keefe's sort of last 3 points. In addition to the delay argument, she claims that the notice of her rights during internal investigation was deficient. That notice complied with NRS 284-387. It's the standard form. In fact, she received 2 notice of rights during internal investigation, 1 before each interview, which is beyond what the statute requires. And this court in the Morgan decision rejected a very similar argument. In Morgan, the employee argued that his notice of internal rights was deficient because it didn't specify certain comments allegedly made during the arrests. This court said, told you what you were being charged of, that's sufficient notice, and that employee hadn't demonstrated any prejudice. Similarly, Ms. O'Keefe hasn't demonstrated any prejudice from the notice she received at the beginning of the investigation. There was an investigation. She eventually received a specificity of charges, which included each of the charges and the detailed account of the facts supporting those, and then she received a pre-disciplinary hearing. So there's no prejudice to Ms. O'Keefe from the notice of rights during internal investigation, and the lack of further detail shouldn't be all that surprising because it's at the beginning of this procedure, and the point of an investigation is to determine sort of the facts at issue. Similarly, the same with the sort of veiled allusions of a due process violation. As Judge Gibbons pointed out, the district court noted that the hearing officer didn't make any claims about a due process violation. Ms. O'Keefe was afforded a full pre-disciplinary hearing. At the appeals hearing, Ms. O'Keefe acknowledged that she was able to fully tell her side of the story at the appeals hearing. That testimony is at 2 RA, I believe 236 to 238. And so she received a full and fair chance to tell her side of the story. And finally, related to Judge Tao's question about whether she was able to revert back and whether the disciplinary proceedings deprived her of that right, the evidence is undisputed that when she returned back to the DMV on September 16th, she filled out all of her rehire paperwork, she became a DMV employee again, and then she was put on administrative leave afterwards. So she'd been rehired, then she was put on notice, and significantly, this was paid administrative leave. If she wasn't, in fact, a DMV employee again, it's unclear how she would have been able to be on paid administrative leave. Unless the court has any other questions. Respectfully request the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
Okay. Were you going to be arguing the other case that was originally set for today?
I wasn't going to be, but I'm familiar with it if Your Honor has a question.
What are you doing?
Better not.
We were looking forward to hearing both cases at the same time, but obviously there was a problem.
Yeah, that is unfortunate. My colleague is disappointed he didn't get a chance.
Okay,
thank you, Your Honor.
We're sorry, too. We weren't so sure yesterday, though, with the weather. So we're glad to be here today. You have about a little over 3.5 minutes.
Okay. Then I'm going to talk very fast. DMV never argued the issue that it took to the district court to the hearing officer. In their brief, which is located at AA-144, they told the hearing officer that she had the authority to determine whether the DMV had just cause to support its decision. Thus, they submitted a just cause issue to her. And just cause in Nevada for state employees is defined in 284.385 as for the good of the public service. Respectfully, I don't think that the Southwest Gas decision on just cause is applicable. That was a private employment setting, and the issues are different. Here we have a statute that controls everything, and it says the good of the public service. So that has to be the analysis that the court would go through.
Well, but really the question is, and this is where you get into the Morgan case versus that 4-3 split case in Costino. Who decides that? Does the hearing officer decide that, or does the hearing officer give deference to the agency's decision on those questions? That's really what that boils down to.
Absolutely, the hearing officer decides that. That's her job. If you look at NRS 284.390 subsection 1, it gives the employee the right to go to the hearing officer for the hearing officer to determine the reasonableness of the action.
Except that the three dissenters in Constantino said the hearing officer the only inquiry from the hearing officer is whether there's substantial evidence for the agency's discipline.
Well, I'm telling you what the statute says, and I would interpret that statute as saying, hearing officer, you get to decide this issue, and frankly, that's what the hearing officers do decide. In the Knapp case and other cases that have been cited to you, the hearing officer is deciding the just cause of the discipline taken. And when they consider just cause of the good of the public service, they consider all these other factors like she did here, like the lack of prior progressive discipline and how she violated the policy, whether she manipulated or disclosed the data and that kind of thing. The other thing is in the Taylor case.
She called up the sheriff at another office and made misrepresentations.
Well, I don't know that she made misrepresentations. She'd off the cuff, she's used to answering the phone, and she said, this is Kara from Motor Carriers, but she says that 100 times a day. And she was asking for information on this friend's driver's license. So I don't know that she made a misrepresentation at all, because I don't know that she said anything that wasn't accurate. But a proper investigation would have helped determine that. But I wanted to briefly touch on the Taylor decision, because the Taylor decision by the Nevada Supreme Court doesn't say that it's up to the appointing authority. The Taylor decision upheld the hearing officer's decision in that case. She simply said that she was going to give it back to the appointing authority to decide the discipline. And ironically, it was the employee's counsel who went up and said, court, tell the hearing officer she has to decide, she can't give it back to the employer. And they said, no, it's within the scope of the statutes and the regulations. If she wants to do it this way, she gets to do it that way. And in Morgan, you upheld the hearing officer's decision. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Kotchka, we know you took this case on through the pro bono program, so this was probably an unexpected trip to Carson City, but you knew you were going to have oral argument.
Yes.
So do you mind if you have to travel to do this through the pro bono program? Does that make any difference about whether you would take another case or? I mean, we always promote the pro bono program, and I know your client's happy, but it's good for the whole state, we think. And I know my colleagues feel pretty strongly about it, too.
Yeah.
Thanks for traveling.
Yeah, we appreciate your participating. There are a lot of people out there who need lawyers and can't afford it, and we need lawyers like you to step up and help them out.
We do appreciate it. We do try to keep, as you can see, the cases from the north in the north so that, you know, the attorneys, whether criminal or civil, don't have to travel as far. This is one of those cases. So we do appreciate your traveling, but we're doing it too. So we're on the same boat. But thank you very much. Your arguments will stand, and the case will stand submitted at this time. And thank you all again.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.